So welcome everyone. We'll go ahead and get started. This session is on raising local livestock and also buying and being a consumer of local meat. For people who are watching either from a different area or later in the year, I will just say it is extremely hot here right now. So we have been in the, in Cochise County, we've been in the, 105 to 110 range for a few days, and it looks like it's going to continue very hot. So I hope everyone stays cool. This webinar is sponsored by the Eat Local Project from the Cochise County Library District. And this is a part of a series of webinars. So if you are interested in local food and have missed some of our previous sessions, they are all archived on the eatlocalcochise.org website. And this webinar will also be archived. So we'll have a video up. Usually we get it up by Friday or Saturday. So just a couple Zoom housekeeping details. Everybody is muted and your cameras are off because we're in a webinar format. So please use either the chat or the Q&A function for any questions you have or anything you want to share, if you want to share resources or other information. We always have a good lively discussion going on these, and we welcome any questions. We're going to have our two rancher panelists are going to speak briefly, and then we're going to open it up to questions. Just a little bit about the Eat Local Project. It's designed to increase awareness of local food options. And in addition to this series of webinars, we're sponsoring and inviting people to a big read this month, to read the book Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver. And copies of that book are in all of our 12 libraries, in the public libraries in the county. And I was I had read the book before, but I'm rereading it. And she had some very interesting things to say about livestock and sustainability practices and that. So that may pertain to some of what we're going to talk about tonight. We also have books and information displays at all of our counties. We're on Facebook and Instagram. We're going to be hosting a couple events this summer, which I'll talk about at the end. And we have a school kit of information, activities, teacher guides, books for kids about local food options that's available for checkout. So if you're a teacher or if you are a homeschooler, or even if you're just a parent looking for some fun activities this summer, that is available. So just some quick introductions. My name is Karen Fassenpower, and I'm the project manager for Eat Local, and I'll just be moderating this. And we have with us today Eric Hess from Dragoon Range Farms, and some of you may have seen Eric on an earlier webinar we did. So he's a returning guest. He was talking before about some of the produce he grows, and today he's going to be talking about his meat operations. And then we also have Dennis Maroney, and I'm going to apologize, Dennis, because I see I misspelled your name on this slide as well. So I apologize for that. It is Maroney with an O. Dennis is from Sky Island Brand 47 Ranch, and he's going to talk with us after Eric. So I'm going to turn it over to Eric to give us an overview of his operations.
Okay, super. Thank you, Karen. Let's see. All right. Can you see my screen now?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So I'm Eric Hess, and I own and operate Dragoon Range Farms. We're in the Kansas settlement area of Wilcox. We have about 130 deeded acres that we run the main farm operation on. And then we have a little bit more than 800 grazing acres that we have leased in the Dragoons. We raise primarily goats, and I would say 90% of those are boar goats for meat applications. We have been experimenting with dairy goats lately, and we're raising some Nubians and some Nigerians. Just to start experimenting with the possibility of entering into like a goat dairy. We have cattle, although our cattle operations are limited. We raise Gelvie cattle and Gelvie crosses with Angus. We've just got into raising swine. I think Dennis, I saw some slides of Dennis's that he's got swine. So maybe between the two of us, we could answer any questions there. And then we raise chickens for egg production. We also do organic. Here's some photos. You can see our boar goats running through the chutes, our cattle.
Eric, I'm sorry. We're not seeing your slides.
Really?
I apologize for interrupting. Try it again, maybe.
Let's see. How about now?
Now we got it.
Yes.
Yep. Thank you.
Yes.
Good, good. Okay. So as you can see, we've got a couple snaps here I wanted to share. All of these are photos that we've taken on our property. And all of these are our animals, with the exception of that huge hog that's standing in front of me, which we borrowed from a friend for breeding. And then, as Karen mentioned earlier, we also are an organic vegetable producer. And this is one of my favorite slides, because you can see that you're producing vegetables in a desert, which is quite a feat. Okay, so I wanted to touch on a few things that I felt were important just to open this discussion in this panel. I'm a huge proponent of worming these animals, and I use ivermectin or Safeguard. Safeguard I use on the goats, ivermectin I use on the cattle, goats, and on the swine. All the drugs that you see here, all these vaccines and drugs, are things that I believe that should have in your toolkit for goat operations. The Bose is a selenium vitamin E supplement that I give at birth, because a lot of the hay in this area, from what I've been told and what my veterinarian has told me, is selenium deficient. And if you aren't giving selenium to these young goats, they're susceptible to a disease called white muscle disease, where they don't develop fully. And I had deaths in these young goats at about 2 to 4 weeks that were really unexplainable. And this is one of the things my veterinarian had consulted with me. Also, CDT vaccinations are important for Clostridium perfringens and tetanus. And then in my emergency kit, I keep penicillin, and then I keep Baytril and Nuflor for respiratory. I've run into a lot of respiratory problems in goats in this area. I don't know if it's from the dust or what, but it starts as a minor infection, and these drugs will knock it out before it becomes serious. Banamine for pain, and then, of course, I keep C&D antitoxin in case an animal does develop enterotoxemia. If you can check that early, then you'll have a better success of saving that animal. The other area that I focus on, would like to focus on, are breeding and herd management. And so you're going to run into situations where if you're raising a large number of goats, we've got about 200 breeding animals for our boar goat operation. You're going to run into a situation where with 200 animals, I usually run about 20 bottle fed babies a year, and various reasons why a mother won't nurse a baby. Sometimes she'll keep one, not another. Sometimes she'll have these babies and simply walk away from them. So if you're there on the spot, you can take these babies and bottle feed them. The one thing I would stress is you want to control the amount of feed, resist the urge to feed whatever that animal will drink, because you can't overfeed them and you'll get a bloated animal, which is a problem. In the top left corner, you can see some of the tools that I use. On the left, I've got an ear tagger. Nationally, the scrapie tags are required. So you've got your tag ID number. And then I use breeder tags also, which are big numbers so that I can track them in my logbook. And then for the unwanted, from the males that you don't want in your breeding program, of course, there's castration. And for an animal as small as a goat, I like using the banding technique. Okay. And then just some contact information in case you have any questions. I'm happy to answer questions. You can see my email there, my telephone number, and my favorite goat that likes to just talk about the operation as much as I do. So, all right, thank you.
Nice. Before we go on to Dennis, You might have said this, and I want to make sure, though, that people know where you are and where your goats are ranging.
Yeah, so I am off of Bell, at the corner of Bell Ranch Road and Parker Ranch Road. If you're familiar with the area out there, I'm kind of between those big dairies. If you're coming, like you're driving to Chiricahua's on, what's that, 181, you would make a left in the big S-turn and go down about 3 or 4 miles, and I'm down there on the left. I'm right off the highway, so you can see me from the highway.
Excellent. Okay. Okay. So I know we have a lot of other questions, but I want to let Dennis give an overview, and then we'll let both of you address questions. So if people do have questions, put them in the Q&A in the chat, and we'll get to them. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dennis.
Okay. My name is Dennis Maroney. I consider myself to be both a food producer and an educator. I have a few degrees from the University of Arizona and a master's from Central Washington University, and I have taught agriculture at the high school and college level for 34 years. And about 20 of those years, I was ranching full-time and teaching part-time as an adjunct faculty member at Yavapai College, Prescott College, and then Cochise College. I started ranching as an 11-year-old, well, I won't call it ranching, but we'll call it livestock production, as an 11-year-old 4-H member. And I've been doing this for most of my life, mainly because I guess I just really love it a lot. And we are located in the southeast corner of Arizona. My house is 18 miles from the Mexican border. We are between Tombstone and McNeil on Davis Road. And our ranch, about 50% of the ranch is actually in the Mule Mountains, the same mountain range that Bisbee is in. And then we drop off in elevation to lower country toward the east. So we ranch from 4,000 feet to 6,500 feet, and in an area that has very diverse soils and a lot of plant diversity. We're primarily producing beef cattle and sheep. I also had boar goats. I had 130 breeding females, but goats have a nose and an eye. I'll just say a nose for trouble and an eye for opportunity, and they never saw the other side of the fence that didn't look better than the one that they were on. And so they went to my neighbors about a dozen times to their open-sided hay barn full of alfalfa, and well, we won't belabor the story, but the goats were sold. I sold them initially to a Mennonite farmer north of us, and then I bought back goats from them for quite a few years, and then even they finally said, you know, these goats are more trouble than they're worth, we're going to go ahead and send them down the road. So I love goats, and I envy Eric's opportunity to raise them without too much trouble. Anyway, over the years, we have also produced pork. When my kids kind of grew up and left home, I had one employee that wanted to continue with the pigs. And then after that, I said, well, there's some privilege to age. And so I'm gonna use my privilege to opt out of pork production. And again, I love pork, but you just have to kind of have a balance with what you can do with the human energy that you have. Let's see, we ranch on about 25,000 acres, which is a mix of private, state, and federal land, with the largest percentage being state land. And we've been here just slightly less than 20 years. We moved here from Prescott, Arizona, where we ranched for 10 years. Prior to that, I was a full-time high school vocational agriculture teacher in Washington State. And prior to that, I was a struggling student at the University of Arizona in Tucson. So my roots in Arizona are most, except for 14 years in Washington, my whole life has been in Arizona. We've been organic since 1972. And I feel that even though we are not certified organic in many ways, we exceed the organic standards. And just for perspective, I do not use, I mean, this will sound to some people terrible, but I don't use any insecticide, any artificial hormones or topical, or I should say subclinical antibiotics. Instead, what we do is rotate our cattle and sheep through 22 pastures on our ranch. And by keeping them moving and paying attention to the fact that most parasite and predators, well, not predators, but parasite cycles are 21 to 28 days, we've been able to deal with most problems in that regard quite well by just keeping the animals moving. And that reinforces our philosophy of take no more than half and always leave at least half when we go through a particular pasture, which is really key to capturing the available rainfall, what we call effective rainfall, which is rainfall that falls on the ranch and goes into the ground. The last 18 months or so have been extremely difficult. And needless to say, the last two decades have been a time to certainly rethink our philosophy regarding drought and aridity and so forth. So if I were to say, what is your most limiting resource, without hesitation, I would say it's water. We work hard to produce or provide water for our animals. And what that means is that we have an extensive system of, we have wells, such as the one pictured right now. Most of them have windmills on them, and all of them have a solar pump. In addition, if they have a windmill, it's in addition to the windmill. We have an extensive network of pipelines and storage tanks and drinkers, and we have made a commitment to the wildlife and to the Arizona Game and Fish Department that we will try to have water in every pasture on the ranch on a year-round basis. This year has made that promise challenging, but we've continued to be able to do it, but not without absolutely daily attention to the water system. It's by far the most fragile part of the whole operation. And we are in an area which historically had more surface water. There was actually a free-running stream in the Mule Mountains in Abbott Canyon called Abbott Creek. And it was so good that the previous owner built a little dam and ran a pipeline 7 miles down to the headquarters and actually irrigated at the ranch headquarters. We have never seen that kind of water abundance in the 20 years that we've been here. Nevertheless, I found it to be a very forgiving ranch in that, while I would say that my experience here has been one of perpetual drought, at the same time, it is frequently alleviated by moisture that comes back, and the landscape is extremely resilient, and the recovery time and the recovery abundance is enough to keep me here when I really honestly probably know better on a bad day. But we have a tremendous variety of plants. And one of the keys to being sustainable and viable in this environment is to have genetics that match the landscape. And so I'd like to speak briefly about that. We have both our cattle and our sheep. And if I ever have goats again, I'll do it with the goats as well. Have the same origin. They originated in North Africa in the Atlas Mountains of Algeria and Morocco at a latitude that's very similar to ours. And they were brought to Spain when the Moors invaded Spain in the 11th century. They ruled Spain for nearly 500 years. And in fact, the unique thing about the voyage of Columbus is that was a resurgence of the Spanish crown retaking the ruling power of Spain from the Moors. And so when the Spanish came to the Western Hemisphere, they brought these Criollo cattle and Churro sheep to the Western Hemisphere. And if you think about provisioning a navy for a navy that had power only from human muscles and wind, they needed to be able to provision the navy, and their tactic was to drop off livestock at any place along the coast that seemed to have a permanent freshwater source. And then they would go back. In some cases, it would just be a hunting operation of domestic animals gone feral. And at other times, it would be that small settlements were established. So I won't belabor the discussion about Criollo cattle and Churro sheep, but the Navajo Churro sheep have been in Arizona for 300 to 400 years. Oñate brought both the cattle and the sheep into this area a long time ago. The Mormon battalion was attacked by feral Criollo bulls at the San Pedro River, and on and on. There's lots of cool history about them. Having previously raised other breeds and been employed by other purebred breeders, I found that these cattle are just amazing for their meat quality and for their ability to utilize a rough, rugged landscape. So with that, I will stop talking and move on to the next phase.
Great, thank you, Dennis. So you talked a little bit about water, and that's the first question that I want to bring up is one that came up on Facebook, because I know that water is a big concern for our county and really for our whole state and increasingly other areas. And I'm wondering if either or both of you could address. So on Facebook, there was a concern that the farms in the county are part of what's depleting our water supply. And so I'm wondering if you could speak to that and perhaps how small scale agriculture has a different effect on the environment than you know, certainly larger industrial sort of agriculture, and anything else you want to say about land stewardship or conservation.
Okay, so is Eric going to answer first, or
however you guys want to do it?
Okay, Eric, do you want to say something?
Yeah, sure. So my operation is a lot smaller than Dennis's, and I was Karen had mentioned this question to me earlier. On our main operation, which is there in the Kansas settlement, we have a big deep water well that's got a big engine in it, but we're not using it. What we challenged ourselves with was to use we have a three horse domestic pump that we're pumping our livestock water with. And then for our organic operation, we moved to underground drip irrigation and row cover. So all of our plants are watered from below. So we're probably using less than Well, we're probably using less water than a normal household would per day on our farm, just using conservation practices. The other thing we're doing in our pastures, we have a much smaller scale pasture. So our rotation, we're only able to rotate about through three pastures on our small piece. And we're experimenting with native grasses. There's an organization out of Sierra Vista that harvests the original grasses of Arizona, which are drought tolerant and use water, and they don't require irrigation once they get started. And so we started experiments with patchwork of that grass to see if we can't replenish the grasses there.
In our situation, we have a farm that has 40 irrigated acres on it. We have not irrigated that for the last 2 years, but we are in the process. I'm actually have things. I'll be actually physically doing this in about 3 weeks, but we've been doing all the background work. But we're converting from flood irrigation to sprinklers on that piece. And that has been the home for our sheep when we like to have them home for lambing and so forth. And we've been doing the same kind of thing. We primarily just irrigate native grasses. We have some Bermuda that comes in by default because where we are, the seeds are so tiny, they're blown in and you know, it's just part of the mix. It's sort of like a naturalized non-native, but we have a static water table. My little farm is right at the bottom of the whitewater draw. So we have water at about 55 feet. We've not felt that our water use is excessive there because we water as a supplemental irrigation two or three times in the spring, and in particular, well, May and June. And then typically the monsoons have covered our water needs for that situation until late September, and usually late September and October, and occasionally if November is still warm enough to get some plant growth, we'll go around two or three times or maybe four times to irrigate just to keep things green. On our rangeland operation, we have 24 constructed ponds. We call them dirt tanks. They're essentially runoff catchments, and that provides the bulk of our water in most years. Last summer, with the monsoon that we experienced, we did catch some water, but it was mostly gone by early November, late October, depending on the particular pond. So if I say a normal year, I've seen so much variation, it's hard to actually characterize that. But I would say that our water use is not excessive, and the fact that there's so little surface water, perennial surface water in the mules, our stewardship of the water, the constructed water infrastructure is very helpful to the wildlife. We have both mule deer and white-tailed deer, javelina, mountain lions, bears, turkeys, three species of quail, and on and on. So the wildlife diversity benefits tremendously from the fact that we have water out there on a year-round basis. And I've identified more than 50 different species of grasses. We have, numerous browse species. So by rotating the cattle frequently and stocking relatively conservatively, I feel like we are modeling what I would consider to be sustainable management for this part of Arizona. And we sell most of what we produce locally directly to the consumer through farmers markets and food co-ops.
Great, thank you. So that's a great segue to the next thing I wanted to ask, which is just for both of you, just really basic, how and where can people buy your product, and in what form, and if you want to talk about pricing or just availability. I know a lot of people are interested, and I'm really, it's a wonderful thing that we have available local meat in the county. I know that's not something that people have everywhere, and people really appreciate that. So tell us about where people can get your products.
So Dennis, go right ahead. I know you've got a much more extensive supply network than I do.
Well, we've been doing this form of marketing. I did some of it back in the 70s in the Yakima Valley in Washington. We had sheep there, but so that was kind of where we started with local marketing. But here we participate in the Bisbee and Sierra Vista farmers markets. We sell to the Bisbee Food Co-op and Food Conspiracy Co-op in Tucson. And then we have several smaller venues, some local restaurants, the Quarry in Bisbee, XO Coffee Roasters in Tucson, a few others. There's a, oh shoot, now I'm gonna forget. Anyway, I'll think of it later. But anyway, that's our primary outlets. We also have a Facebook page, which is 47 Ranch / Sky Island Brand. And we take orders and send out price lists. We never have a published price list on the web just because sometimes people will mess with things and we don't want to deal with that. But I would say that our products are priced consistent with prices that you would probably pay at Safeway, perhaps a little bit more than that, but with several things that I think make it a lot more of a buy. And without being too, well, you know, this is my chance to talk about what we do. We have, first of all, 100% guarantee of customer satisfaction. If a person buys a piece of meat or they buy a whole animal from us, we guarantee their satisfaction, and we will either refund their money or replace whatever it was that they were dissatisfied with. And to be honest with you, we don't very often have to honor that warranty because we pretty well have, I think we're doing a good job of producing a high quality product. We're in the process. I have a student who's a PhD student at U of A who has been working with us for 6 years. She began by with a 3-month internship. She's a student from France. She's now writing her dissertation focused on grazing behavior and diet selection of our Criollo cattle and how that behavior translates to meat quality and flavor. And so she has used GPS locator collars and fecal analysis and lipid analysis taken from fat samples from pretty much every animal that we've slaughtered over the last 5 years. And essentially with the goal of both verifying the often stated health claims of all natural grass-fed meat, and secondly, helping to define the terroir or that localness of a particular flavor. And we feel like, I really think that when she publishes her dissertation and then we're able to write up some stories and so forth, it's going to kind of blow the doors off the conventional meat business, because our animals are grazing on plants that are known to be toxic, but we feel that they nibble at those and they're actually self-medicating, and that is helping them to have parasite resistance and we basically don't experience any health problems. We have physical injuries as probably our only real veterinary issue, although occasionally plant consumption will be a concern. But that's probably enough on that for now. Thank you.
Thank you. So Eric, where can people get your goat meat?
People generally come directly to us. A lot of people like to butcher their own, and so they'll come and pick the animals up for us, because a lot of the times they prepare them whole for events and things of that nature. I also have relationships with about 3 different butchers that if someone doesn't want to get involved in that, I'll drop the animal off at the butcher and then they can come and pick it up. We don't process animals on our facility yet. It's something that we've talked about, but it's not something that we've gotten into.
Great. So tell, for people who don't know, tell more about the butchering process and what the regulations are, what challenges that provides for you, and whether both of you sell, I believe, by the half and the whole animal, and what does that look like for a consumer who isn't used to buying that way? A lot of questions, but go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, so with our cattle, I mean, we do have customers that like you say, they want a half or a whole. And since we don't process our own meat and we use our relationships with the butcher, as far as the regulation on our farm is concerned, we pass that on to the butcher. We use AZDA inspected facility. And our responsibility essentially ends when we drop that animal off and the butcher takes custody of it. At that point, the customer is working directly with the butcher for the cuts of meat and what the, you know, how they want it prepared and what weights that they want the packaging to be in. When a person buys a full cow, for me, if it's in, I've got a upright freezer that's taller than I am, and a full cow will fill that freezer. So that'll give you some perspective.
Yeah.
We do the same thing with, we've had one run with hogs, and we've actually, essentially our operation could be called custom finishing. So we're finishing the hogs, we're finishing the cows, and then we're dropping those off at the butcher. We do the exact same process with the hogs.
Dennis?
Yeah, so for us, we have used the University of Arizona Food Products and Safety Lab as our primary source for processing for probably, for most of the last 20 years. It's a USDA inspected plant, and it's the only organically certified plant in the Southwest. But we also use Wilcox Meatpacking and what's now called Cattleman's Processing, which was, most people would know it as Guzman's Meats, which Bernie Guzman had operated that for quite a while. It was also USDA certified. Wilcox Meats is state certified. So the certification is important for having the ability to retail individual cuts to customers. We also do sell whole and half animals, and those are normally paper wrapped rather than cryovac, so that the cost to the customer is lower and the price per pound is lower. It's by far the best bargain for the money. And basically what we do is we take orders typically through our Facebook page, and we collect a deposit ahead of time, which means our customer will be committed. And, you know, we have had the situation of somebody purchasing a half or a whole and then being, you know, their things have changed and they've said, well, we don't want to take it now. So we've found that since the pandemic, one set of circumstances has had a huge effect on us. It's kind of a two things taking place. One is that one of the first groups of people to have remarkably higher incidence of COVID in packing house workers. And this was primarily taking place in the big commercial, you know, slaughter facilities owned by the big four meat cartels. And the upshot of that, it came out with some, and I'm not sure if they were regulations, guidelines, or recommendations, but anyway, we'll call them recommendations for floor square footage of floor space per worker in order to have a safe work environment. The upshot of that for U of A was that they essentially had to furlough half of their staff, which meant that their productive abilities were significantly reduced, wait times were longer, access to processing was less. And at the same time, grocery store shelves were coming up empty or very light on meat supply. And so we began to see many more new customers who had never shopped with us before and who would buy one or two items and then come back the next week and say, oh my gosh, this meat has the best flavor I've ever experienced. Well, you know, we'll never go back to this or that store. And so we had increasing demand and a kind of a decreasing ability to supply that demand. And so at that point, we had to start getting really creative about how we were going to deal with it. So we now have, I mean, I literally have animals at three different facilities, U of A, Wilcox, and what's now called Cattlemen's Processing, which is in Cochise. And we are selling more whole and half animals than we ever did in the past. We also tell people that they can purchase a quarter, but that they have to find the other person to buy the other half of the half. So that's how we've been handling it. And in fact, for the first time since I started doing this, you know, seriously in 1996, in other words, selling direct to the public, we had to skip 2 weeks worth of farmers markets. We'll be going back to Sierra Vista on the 24th of June after being absent for two markets, and the same thing with Bisbee the following Saturday. So that's, you know, and I have often thought, like Eric, that's our weakest link in the whole chain, is that we don't do our own processing. But I'm too old to do that now. I like the idea of it. And at one point my son was talking about being very interested in it, but he didn't follow through with that. So anyway, yeah.
Well, I know that's a problem nationwide, and certainly in some of the books we've read about this, there's just a lot of talk about the regulation on that and just the extreme expense to be able to do processing, that it just keep, that's why there aren't more butchers, because it's just, it's not feasible. So,
yeah.
When people order a half or a whole animal, how long ahead do they have to tell you, and what for people who haven't done that, it seems intimidating. What do they need to know? Like, do they, I think Eric said they make the arrangements with the butcher, or that's optional, or how does that work?
We do it a little bit differently because we take the customer's order and then we talk with them about cutting instructions and what their preferences are. We have a poster that's put out by the Beef Council, which is cuts of beef. We have a similar thing for cuts of lamb. And we try to walk them through the process. And often we'll talk about, well, what do you like to eat? What's your favorite cut? What are the things that are really important to you? Some families with young kids want a lot of ground product. They want ground beef. Other people really love steaks. And you have some options with cutting where a roast could be a roast or it could be cut into steaks. Once, for instance, a standing rib roast, they won't get rib eyes. They won't get bone-in rib steaks. You have to make decisions. So there's a lot of, I guess I would call it personal education. We have a YouTube channel which has some videos on it that help people, you know, to kind of get to know a little bit more about that. And basically, we used to be able to say that 4 to 6 weeks from the time that you order and pay your deposit, you could be picking up your meat from us. And now we have to say, well, we can't guarantee, you know, because of these longer timelines, for us to just get a slot is a big deal for processing, get an appointment. And I'm hoping that as we move further along with more people vaccinated and so forth, we'll be able to do some things. And I'll just say one last thing. There was a notice that came out this last week from the USDA that they, Secretary Vilsack said that there was maybe $4 billion that was being allocated for changes to our food supply system with more attention to small and medium-sized producers and small and medium-sized processing facilities. And if what that means is that we have either regulations that are scaled to small and medium-sized operations and not the regulations that right now one size fits all, and they're really made for these giant facilities that process thousands of animals in a day. And we've always worked maybe process 20 animals a week. And so we feel that it shouldn't cost $1 million to open a plant like that. And I know when I was growing up, every town had one or two or three kind of mom and pop scale facilities where you could take your pig or your goat or your lamb or your steer and have it processed for family use. And that's hard to find anymore. So anyway, that's.
Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. I will look for some references to that. And if people are interested, I know, you know, a lot of times they're making these regulations and they talk about small producers. And then by the time it gets through the process that's lawmaking, that gets dropped. But I also know that our legislatures like to hear from real people who have concerns about this. So we will try to share out some of that information. I think that's an issue, not just in meat, but in all kinds of food areas that we've all really been struggling with. Yeah. Eric, how about you on lead time?
Well, we, like Dennis said, the pandemic really affected us because with a goat, it's about the same. You know, if you contact me and you want a goat, you want it dropped off at the butcher. Usually it's about, I would say about, it's running to probably about 6 to 8 weeks now. There was a time when I couldn't get a slot at the butcher for 6 months. And so last year, I was taking orders on cows probably 6 months in advance, just because if someone came to me at 4 months, I don't think I could have gotten an appointment for them.
Wow.
So hopefully that's going to get a lot better as the time progresses. We typically, we finish our cows because we have such small pasture area, and we typically finish them for about 4 months. So, you know, in a normal year, you're probably looking at about that much lead time.
So for people who don't know what that means, tell us what that means.
So ours are grass fed until we'll take a steer when it's about 800 pounds. And then we'll bring it in, we'll bring it off the range, and we'll bring it out to our farm operation, and we'll start supplementing it with some grain so that we get marbling. And then, so we do that for about 4 months before slaughter.
Okay. So we're kind of running down on time. I want to get in a couple just really short questions to let you answer. And then we have one bigger question we'll see if we can give a quick pass at. So Christine is asking, what's the average weight of a lamb and of a steer? And I'll say also of a goat, just ballpark.
Okay. So for us, I'd like to slaughter a lamb at 125 pounds. And that gives you carcass edible meat in the range of 40 to 42 pounds. With a steer, we have been ideally, I'd like for a steer to be about 1,100 pounds. We use 1,000 pounds as kind of a threshold. We have kind of moved away from the term grass-fed because we prefer to use the term range-fed or range-raised because our cattle eat a lot of shrubs and lower leaves of trees. We were surprised to find that they were browsing a little bit they definitely eat prickly pear during the winter. In the spring, their primary feed for May and June is mesquite, grass-fed, but I've found that the marbling, you don't lose anything on tenderness, but you gain on marbling. If you can take an animal, carry the animal up to about 1,150 pounds or so, and that means that a whole, if a person purchased a whole beef, they would be looking at getting about 650 pounds of meat to put in their freezer. So the rest, when you say, well, what's the rest of that weight? They have just their digestive system it's amazing. I mean, there's 25 or 30 gallons of water in there constantly. The rumen is a big fermentation vat and depends heavily on the activity of microbes that help digest coarse feed and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So. Eric, weight on yours?
So with our steers, ours are exactly what Dennis is doing. Same exact weights. On the goats, we typically, customers prefer them to be, some customers like them around the 60 pound range. Some customers like them around the 80 to 90 pound range. So you're looking at, after processing, about 45 to 65 pounds of meat. A lot of people like to, when they do goat roasts, they like to do the entire animal, which is why a lot of people like them in that range. Hogs, we typically raise to about 250 pounds. You can expect about 160 pounds of meat from that pig.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. And then Eric, another quick question for you. Richard asks, can the vaccines that you talked about be used for cattle mm-hmm. as well?
So the vaccines that I put in the picture were largely used for goats, but some of them do cross over. I use on my cattle, I also use CDT for Clostridium perfringens and tetanus. But I use a product called UltraVac 7 because it vaccinates the cows against blackleg and respiratory diseases. For worming, I also use the ivermectin on the cattle. I don't use the safeguard, but I use the ivermectin.
Okay, thank you. And then we have a follow-up question on the processing. What are the regulations regarding of processing a single cow on your own property? And I believe it's not for resale, but for personal use is all you can do. Am I right on that?
Yeah, I think the only concerns there would be that it is supposed to be done in a humane manner and with compliance to all sanitary sanitation considerations. So if a person wants to buy a live animal and process it on their own property, provided that it's done humanely and within the guidelines of healthy practices, I don't think there's any issue.
But they would have to do that themselves. You correct. Cannot do that for someone and sell it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I have had some customers that have asked to process animals here on site, and I've done it with lambs and goats, but not with other animals. And it's mostly folks from the Muslim community that prefer to do that. And there's some very, they say some prayers and go through a particular process for doing that. And they're all of the people that I have had do that here at our place. I've been very impressed with how competent they were. So.
Are you aware of any itinerant butchers or butchers that people could hire to do this in the county?
So it's interesting that Dennis brought up Bernie Guzman lately. Bernie is actually my neighbor, and he stopped by a few weeks ago and told me that he was doing a mobile processing, that he's obviously licensed or has the proper regulatory requirements to do that, just because he's got probably 40 years of experience doing custom butchering. But he said that he's starting up a mobile operation to be able to do just that on people's farms.
Excellent. Yeah. We will try to find information on that and push it out to people when we send the notes from this.
Yeah. And I have his contact information if you great. Need it. Cool. I'm sorry Thank about you. My dog.
No, that's okay. That's great. Something to add, Dennis?
Well, I just was going to say, I know that Bernie has all the skills. I mean, he's extremely competent. So I wouldn't hesitate to use his skills.
Yeah. Great. Thank you for that information. And then we have one more question that's kind of a big question, and we are winding down. But if you have just a couple minutes, Robin's asking about what your waste process looks like. And then she sort of has some additional questions about water and climate, which I think we've kind of talked about, but any waste processing or composting? Well, I don't know.
I'll tell you what we do. Everything, every surplus product, if it's a meat-based waste, generally goes to our dogs and cats. And if it is anything from the garden, and that would include eggshells and things like that, everything goes to the chicken coop, and then we rake out the chicken coop, and it goes to compost and goes to the garden. So I don't think of it as waste. I think of it as just cycling these resources back through the soil. And soil health is a big deal for us.
Yeah, we do the exact same thing. We take our horse and cattle and goat manure along with eggshells and anything from the garden and compost that. And then we don't have any butcher waste just because we outsource it all.
Do you think across the county with what people, the number of people that are raising animals, is there a market for a commercial waste operation, composting or something like that? Or is everybody pretty much using it on site themselves, do you think?
We use ours. I don't know. Dennis,
maybe. Well, we have people that come to us periodically to get manure. And we only have a few settings where they could actually collect manure, you know, where we have animals concentrated for a period of time. So I do pen our sheep at night, just to protect them from predators. And so there's a concentration of sheep manure in that situation. We do have some places where horses are funny because they prefer to poop in the same location a lot of times. So there'll be a corner of a bigger corral or pasture where they would tend to put more on the ground. But generally speaking, I feel like we're recycling and redistributing the material that our animals are eating out on the land where it will, you know, regenerate the soil out there. And so I have one quick, it's kind of a funny story, but I know we're in a quick hurry. There was a lady who I encountered at the Sierra Vista Farmers Market who wanted to get some manure. And she didn't have a car. She always showed up at the market with a little cart and a walking stick. And so I said, well, I'll bring you some in some dog food bags. And she was riding the Sierra Vista Metro bus. And so the bus driver was helping her load her bags of manure onto the bus. And it was just really cute. And he was really great about it. He said, yeah, we get all kinds of weird stuff. Don't worry about it. You know, and it was just kind of funny. But
it's the nice thing about living in a rural area.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's about 7 o'clock. I want to thank the two of you very much for sharing with us tonight, but really for doing the work that you do. I know it's hard work and not probably financially commensurate with the amount of work, but I know you both love what you do, and our county really benefits from having so many producers like you. And I would just remind people, as we were talking about different regulations and different labels, that a lot of this, it really is dependent on you knowing where your food comes from, and get to know people. Go to the farmers market and ask people, because a lot of things like grass-fed or pasture-raised or free-range, there's no regulatory definition, and so often those terms are co-opted by people who don't have as much of a sense of land and animal stewardship as the growers, the producers you've heard from today. So definitely get to know where your food comes from. And we're lucky in this county to have such great ranchers and producers who really care about what they do. And we're fortunate to have them here in the county. So thank you. If I missed any questions, you can certainly email us or post on Facebook. Just really quickly, we have a lot of additional resources at our libraries on raising animals, and also lots of great cookbooks. We are going to have a celebration of eating local at the Elfrida Library, July 23rd, and we will have, we're still finalizing details, but we will have a couple different farmers and ranchers, and hope that maybe Eric and or Dennis can join us there. Cooperative Extension is going to be there. We're going to have just all kinds of things going on, plus a lot of activities for kids. And then we will be soon announcing a second one of those in another location in the county. So watch for that on our Facebook and Instagram. And I've put up links to that. Feel free to email us anytime. We are winding down the webinar series. In 2 weeks, we're going to have a book discussion of Animal Vegetable Miracle, and then we're winding down the webinars with that for the summer. But we have had just a great response to this project, and I feel like we've really been able to connect some producers with consumers. What from people I've talked to, I think the demand for local food in our county is very, very high. And I hope that we continue to see the growth of our local food system. And we will continue on these channels to try to do whatever we can to support that. So any closing words, Eric or Dennis?
No, it's just, you're absolutely right. It's hard work. And I think Dennis voiced it really well earlier. If you love what you're doing, then it makes the hard times a little bit easier, but it's good to be able to, you know, use good stewardship with these animals. And when you see healthy, happy animals, it just gives you a good feeling.
Well, I would totally agree. I feel really privileged and honored to be able to live my dream, in the sense that this is what I really always wanted to do from the time I was a little kid. I don't know, some kind of maybe genetic memories or something. But anyway, I'm thankful for all of our customers who have enabled us to do what we do. And I just want to put in a plug for our YouTube channel that will give people a chance to get a little bit better picture, I guess, of how we do what we do. And the name of that channel is Ranching in the Right Hemisphere. It's a reference to the two brain hemispheres and the fact that modern commercial corporate agriculture is really stuck in the left brain. Crunching numbers, if it's profitable, they can just ignore the ethics of process, you know, to bring food to the grocery system. And by giving a little bit of airtime to the right brain side of things, which looks at aesthetics and looks at the humanity and sentient nature of our relationship with these animals, I think it's really a much better end product and a much better human existence or human experience. So that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Great closing thoughts. We could use more of that probably in all areas of life. We will share out that YouTube link, as well as the links to Eric's farm page and both of the Facebook pages. After our webinar, we send an email. If you're not seeing those, check your spam, but we'll also post it on Facebook. So thank you very much. And thank you for everyone who attended. Get out there and support our local food producers. Thanks, everybody.